Welcome to episode 144 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is Karen Geyer. She's a Toronto-based writer and content strategist, making her fourth appearance on the podcast. Karen, welcome back to Junk Filter.
I have to do one more of these so then I can be in the special five-timers club, right?
That's true. Well, I'll be issuing special coins to all my five-time guests.
And then I can walk around and like steal valor and be like, you don't even know. This is my challenge coin.
Karen asked to come on the show to talk about the passing of one of our heroes, Paul Rubens, and his immortal character, Pee-wee Herman, a comedy hero, a patron saint of modern culture, a queer icon, a legend.
Man, this one really hit hard, especially because I was like in the middle of something at work and it like showed up on my Twitter and I was like, oh my God, I don't have time to like react to this right now. I have to react to this later. And I hate experiences like that.
It didn't even occur to me that somebody like Paul Rubens could die.
I know. I mean, I follow Charo on Instagram, and it's the same thing. Like, one day there's going to be a notice that Charo passed, and I'm going to not be able to handle it.
He and Tim Burton made one of the funniest movies I've ever seen, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. And the following year, Rubens created Pee-wee's Playhouse, which I think is one of the greatest shows ever created. Not only one of the greatest TV shows for children, but one of the best TV shows, period.
Yeah, that's right.
But one thing I didn't really know until later on was that the whole idea of Pee-wee's Playhouse stemmed from a stage show that he did as far back as 1980, which was called The Pee-wee Herman Show. It was filmed for HBO as a special. And as part of my research for the episode, I finally watched it. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I've talked about this on your show before, but like our house was one of the pay TV houses. And like, I think that was the first time I saw it, either that, or like, I also had an uncle who was like super into like weird stuff. So it was one of those two sources, but I think it was pay TV.
He created the Pee-wee Herman character in 1977 because Rubens was part of the LA comedy improv team, the Groundlings. That's where he met, I believe he met Phil Hartman then, and he met Jan Hooks then. Mm-hmm. And at first, the Pee-wee character was supposed to be a bad comedian who was destined to fail. And this was based on Rubens' experience watching other stand-up comedians in the 70s. The character morphed into the Pee-wee that we know today over the course of those years. But he went into overdrive when he auditioned to be part of the cast of Saturday Night Live in 1980. But he lost out to Gilbert Gottfried. Turns out to be a blessing in disguise because that was the notorious terrible season of SNL.
Yeah, I was just going to say the Gene Demanian season.
Yeah. So it's sad that Rubens wasn't a part of that. But if you watch stuff like Cheech and Chong's next movie and
yes,
and stuff, he appears in those films. He's very funny in it.
I was going to ask if you remembered that he was in Cheech and Chong movies. He's in two of them, right? He's in Cheech and Chong's next movie, and then he's also in Nice Dreams. He plays a coke addict in Nice Dreams.
Yes. SNL's loss was culture's gain because Rubens channeled the frustration of not getting on SNL into expanding on the Pee-wee Herman character. He got victory several years later when he got to host Saturday Night Live as Pee-wee Herman.
Mm-hmm. Did you look up the musical guest for that?
No.
Okay. 1985, Saturday Night Live, Pee-wee Herman host, episode Pee-wee Herman / Queen Ida and the Bon-Ton Zydeco Band.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. I was like, that was back when they were taking some chances on that show musically.
On the Pee-wee Herman show that he did for stage, it is basically Pee-wee's Playhouse. It's got some smuttier jokes. Mm-hmm. It's not for children.
Right.
For instance, he's got mirrors on his shoes so he can look up women's skirts.
Yeah. And there's there's a lot of like sexual innuendo that like we would find very tame now because we go on to a website every day where people talk about how horny they are. But it has some innuendo. The thing that I thought was interesting is that in the transition between that show and actually the children's television show, they got rid of the repair guy. So I don't know if you remember on the special, but he was like this like muscled, like Latino guy who like was just like, he was, there was like horny vibes coming off of this guy. And I'm sure that they got rid of him on the television show, the children's television show, because mm-hmm. like the implication that like village people like kind of implication, but for children. And I think that that's an interesting choice because it says that a lot of his stuff like did not get any kind of like, you know, notes back from the producers or censorship or anything, but they asked for a few key changes. And I'm thinking that some of the key changes were removing some queer coded stuff that was maybe a little bit more obvious. I mean, it's still a very queer show.
Yes.
But this kind of stuff where even like a Mormon watching would get it.
Yeah, and there are some carryover characters from the Pee Wee Broadway show.
Oh yeah,
like Captain Carl is in it, and mm-hmm. John B. the Genie and Terry Dactyl all appear. The mailman.
Yeah. Also, the guy who plays John B. died last year as well.
Oh no.
Yeah.
On the stage show, he worked with some gods of comedy, household names later on, like Phil Hartman. But are you familiar with Edie McClurg? Because I loved her.
Of course.
She Crow wrote the Broadway show.
Okay.
Edie McClurg used to show up a lot on WKRP and on David Letterman. Mm-hmm. I think of Letterman and Pee Wee Herman as two guiding lights for me and my sense of humor when I was a kid, because Letterman and Pee Wee were both obsessed with 50s and 60s, you know, kid shows and amateur mm-hmm. hour on television. And mm-hmm. I learned so much about irony and camp from both Letterman and Pee Wee Herman. And Pee Wee was a regular guest on David Letterman, like long before he became a superstar.
Yeah.
He kept bringing him on.
I mean, you got to think that they shared like that irreverence and that, you know, idea that like we all work hard and we should probably like take time in our day to actually enjoy life, you know? And I think that I know that there's lots of stories about David Letterman, the person, that probably don't pay that off as well as they do with Paul Rubens. But,
yeah.
you know, I think that, you know, you can definitely see a through line with the comedy there.
Letterman had such a good eye for very, very strange personas. Well, they used the fact that they couldn't book major guests in the early years of the show to their advantage. So they booked whoever they could, and then they mm-hmm. found weirdos on, like Brother Theodore and things like that. So Pee Wee kind of filled that gap because he was like a cult comedy hero.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that also the latter day Letterman stuff like really did pay that off as well. Like Will It Float, Rupert G and the Hello Deli, like some things, you know, just really kept going with that same ethos. And that, you know, that's kind of beautiful that he was able to keep that going as long as he did, even though he could get, you know, Tom Hanks to come on whenever he wanted and stuff like that.
One other thing that I loved about Pee Wee is that he never, ever broke character.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know who Paul Rubens was. It was very surreal at first when you started seeing Paul Rubens out of character as Pee Wee. He was basically Pee Wee Herman, as far as mm-hmm. I was concerned, you know? Like,
mm-hmm. Well, I know we're going to go into this more, but do you remember what his mugshot looked like?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really like took a turn after that show got canceled. He really like went outside of character. That's for sure.
he must have been vaguely relieved to be able to drop the character, because he was pretty much Pee Wee for something like 13 or 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do for an encore also when you create Pee Wee Herman?
Yeah, exactly.
Warner Brothers is proud to present The Story of a Guy.
Warning, I'm here.
And his bike.
James Bond kind of stuff.
Together for the first time in their first big movie.
I meant to do that.
Pee Wee took his cult success to the big screen in 1985 for Warner Brothers. The feature debut of Tim Burton, and if I'm honest, it's still my favorite Tim Burton movie. I don't think he's ever topped Pee Wee.
So, right off the top, Pee Wee's Big Adventure is my all-time favorite movie, period. End of sentence. It is there. There are three movies I've reviewed on Letterboxd. Number one, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and the review is best movie of all time. Number two is Pee-wee's Big Holiday, and the review is second best movie of all time. The third one is the Val Kilmer classic, Top Secret, and my review for that is how silly can you get with a question mark? And that's it.
That's the Karen Geyer canon.
That is. I will never update that Letterboxd unless somebody puts a gun to my head.
Well, it is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen, and it's a perfect synthesis of two different artists working together.
Yeah. And it also has that, the thing that Big Holiday sort of lacks that Big Adventure had is that it has a little bit of tattiness and grittiness and, you know, patina, whatever you want to call it, where you can tell it was made on a shoestring. You can tell they went to these weird and wonderful locations because that's what they could afford. And that really makes for, you know, beautiful art, I think.
It was very successful. It wasn't that expensive to make. It had a huge return on investment. And I think it paved the way for Burton to make Beetlejuice and then Batman. It all started with Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah, gross like 8 times what it cost, right? So that's a pretty good return on investment.
Yeah, and I watched it fairly religiously. I think I've seen it in theaters like 4 or 5 times.
Oh, wow. When
I was getting ready for the podcast, I was like, I have this movie committed to memory. I don't really need to watch it again.
Yeah.
It has one of my favorite comedy scenes of all time, which is the sequence at the Alamo.
Yes.
With my queen, Jan Hooks, as the incredible tour guide.
At this time, I'd like to conclude our tour, and I mean it. Y'all have been one of the greatest groups I have ever worked with, really. Okay, are there any questions? Yes.
Where's the basement?
Excuse me?
Aren't we going to see the basement?
There's no basement at the Alamo.
There was a sweet tribute to Pee-wee when he passed away where the Alamo tweeted that they were sorry that he was gone.
Yeah.
And that they've also built a tiny little basement in the gift shop of the Alamo in his honor.
I have had the pleasure of visiting the Alamo, and it is true there is no basement there. So you have the KG guarantee on that one.
Did you go because of the movie?
No, I went because I was in San Antonio with my parents.
It's like, we need to go to the Alamo.
Yeah.
I love Jan Hooks, and I wish that she'd had a bigger career. She apparently was very shy about being famous. I think Saturday Night Live was all the fame that she wanted. She turned down roles all the time. But if in a just world, she would have had a big, big career. It's too bad that she didn't want it.
You could tell that she still had it going on. Like, you know, sometimes that doesn't always happen. Sometimes people take a hiatus and they come back and it's like, woof. You know, like Molly Ringwald, I think, like, kind of faltered when she had her adult career after being a teen. And then, you know, she kind of low-key fell off. And, you know, I only saw her in a couple episodes of Riverdale, so I can't really vouch for, like, how it's been since. But, you know, when Jan Hooks came back on 30 Rock, she was amazing. She was so funny. And like, I still remember the part where she's talking to Jack about like her breast lift or whatever. She's like, no, but you see, I got the meat. I got the meat. Like, oh.
Also, Paul Rubens was really funny on 30 Rock.
Yes. Yeah. As a Habsburg,
it's like an adult Habsburg child or something.
Which is extremely funny because like, he grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family. Like, so like the Habsburgs, not exactly the biggest fans of Judaism in the world. But yeah.
Do you know much about young Paul Rubens and his upbringing?
I know that his dad was like an ex-military guy. They owned a lamp store. The mom was a teacher or something, right? He tried out for a bunch of different university performing arts programs and got like shut out of all of them except for Cal Arts, which is one of the hardest ones to get into. And like everybody that was on television from about 1972 to 1994 went through that program.
And the Groundlings also very competitive to get in there.
Yeah. Yeah, and he was in with quite a cohort.
Back to Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yes.
What an incredible beginning to that movie with that Rube Goldberg thing, yeah. Getting his breakfast ready.
The breakfast machine.
And him eating Mr. T cereal. Mm-hmm. Nothing is happening for the first few minutes of the movie, yeah. Except for Pee-wee having a wonderful morning. I love the villain in the movie, Francis Buxton. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, Ron DeSantis is Francis Buxton.
Oh, yeah.
When I look at him, all I can think of is Francis.
That's funny. So we can have like one of our is a hot dog a sandwich type conversations about him, about Francis, because, you know, they show him in a indoor pool, but it has bubbles in it. Is that his bathtub or is that a pool that has bubbles in it? Discuss. Talk amongst yourselves. Discuss.
I wouldn't sell my bike for all the money in the world. Not for $100 billion, $1 trillion.
Then you're crazy.
I know you are, but what am I?
You're a nerd.
I know you are, but what am I?
You're an idiot.
I know you are, but what am I?
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 I know you are, but what am I? Infinity.
No, I'm not.
You are.
No way. Knock it off.
Cut it out.
Oh, shut up, Pee-wee.
Why don't you make me?
Why don't you make me?
Because I don't make monkeys. I just train them.
The other funny thing about all of the stuff in Pee-wee's Big Adventure is that they're of indeterminate age.
Right.
Even Francis might be a man in his 30s,
right.
Who's walking around like a teenage boy.
Right. And that's sort of like one of these wonderful things that is never like, it's never explained. Like, even in Big Holiday, it's obvious that Pee-wee is older, but it's not obvious that he is now an adult man, except for the fact that he has a job working in a kitchen counter. But you could be 15 years old and working at a kitchen counter. So,
what are your favorite parts from Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
So I really like the when he calls everybody down to his basement. Mm-hmm. And he like gets really serious and then he like honks off the horn to his bike and he's like, do you have something to say, Amazing Larry?
I found an incredible story about that scene. They did film a scene with Amazing Larry that was cut from the movie. There was an additional scene with Amazing Larry. Warner Brothers said, you got to cut that scene out. And since you have to cut that scene out, you also have to cut out the part with Amazing Larry in the basement meeting. And Burton and Ruben said, no, 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 we'll keep it. And Ruben said, it's going to make people laugh. They don't need to know
right. Who
Amazing Larry is. The fact that a middle-aged man with a mohawk is named Amazing Larry,
yeah. That'll
make everyone laugh. And it's so funny. He was totally right.
Yeah. And then the other part I love is when he is in the pet store and he has to rescue the snakes. Yeah. And he's just like, oh, because we've all like felt that exact feeling of like, I gotta fucking do something I don't want to do, but this is the only moral choice. Like, fuck me. And it's just such a beautiful, hilarious representation of that, because it's like, you know, what a ridiculous situation to find yourself in.
The large Marge scene is incredible.
Yes. Okay.
And so in the theater, it works. It's a jump scare.
I was terrified of large Marge as a child. pay TV household. We were over at my parents' friend, like their best friend's house, and they had two boys. One boy was older than me. One boy was younger than me. And they were into video games, like Guns N' Roses. They were into like all this stuff that was like not like accessible to the average like theater nerd, dance, like, you know, whatever girl. and they were like, we want to watch this movie. And I was like, okay, cool. Really enjoyed this movie. And then it got to that part and I was like, so fucking scared. I like excused myself to go to the bathroom and I freaked out for a little bit. I was like, had to catch my breath.
But I can vouch for a movie theater full of people jumping when the reveal happens.
And it's so stupid. If you see like a, you know, like just a frame of that, it's the most fucking ridiculous thing you've ever seen. And they must have had an absolute blast building that model.
Yeah.
But like as a kid, I was like, no, like it's like my uncle had a dog that was so they got like some gag gifts one year for Christmas and they found out then and there that their big like, you know, golden lab was terrified of a chia pet. Like pants shittingly scared, like, and they like could, like they had to get rid of it, they had to give it away to somebody because this dog was so fucking scared of it. Like that's, you know, that's the reaction I had. I'm sure that's the reaction some other like wimpy ass kids did as kids as well.
The sequence with the biker gang at the biker bar is legendary. Yes.
Oh yeah. I mean, I didn't choose that just because like to me, like when I close my eyes and I think of like one of the funniest things, I think of that pet's shop. So it's like I can't pick the bikers.
Massive laugh in the biker gang scene where he is welcomed in as a biker. And yeah. they give him a roadster and then he immediately drives off. Yes. And goes right through a billboard.
Yeah.
It looked like a stunt that actually hurt the stuntman too.
But you know, it also for the early 80s, it was probably pretty revolutionary to be like, hey, these bikers are like nice guys. Yeah. Because they are. They, you know, you said something before we started recording about how on the show, like the children's television show, there weren't a lot of villains and like, you know, it just people who were misunderstood. And really the bikers were sort of that proxy in the movie, like, and they show up in a big way for Pee-wee.
Yeah, there's really only two bad guys in Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Francis, obviously, and then the boyfriend of the waitress.
Right. How dare you be that way to Simone?
Yeah, Simone, I was surprised when Simone showed up in Pee-wee's Big Holiday.
I know, and they gave her such an amazing arc. Yeah. I loved it. I loved it.
Also, the other huge laugh is when it goes postmodern at the end and Warner Brothers is making a movie about, like,
right.
They give him his bike back in exchange for the rights.
Yeah.
To make a movie out of his life. And they get James Brolin to play P.W. Herman. And yes. He's dressed in the same suit. And then they have a cameo with Pee-wee as a bellboy where they've dubbed his voice.
Yes. It's so funny. Paging Mr. Herman, Mr. Pee-wee Herman. Oh my God.
And there's also this running joke throughout the whole movie of all these women who are like madly in love with Pee-wee Herman and he's completely disinterested.
Yeah. Yeah. And so maybe now is as good a time as ever to talk about the queer coding of like everything mm-hmm. that he's done. It's like, you know, the original stage show had like queer themes to it. Obviously, Jambi has like a very like Southern hairdresser confidant vibe going on, mm-hmm. You know, and like, you know, this idea that these women are all throwing themselves at Pee-wee and he's not interested. You know, some people are like, oh, that's so nice. He's so pure. And other people are like, uh-huh, same, honey. So,
what they would refer to later as a confirmed bachelor.
Right. You know, and at a time when it was weirdly, the closet was shutting on a lot of people because of the AIDS crisis. So people who, you know, before the AIDS crisis happened would have probably come out and lived their lives and been happy, you know, we're starting to be like, oh, I don't want to be associated with people who have this disease. So it was a really weird time for queer joy, for queer celebration. So this is kind of a side door way that people got to experience that. And I'm sure that there's lots of queer kids out there that are grateful that they had even that, you know, vibe in his work. And I mean, you know, Big Adventure, it has, I would say, probably a little bit more of that because of the nature of they weren't trying to, you know, drive it towards kids necessarily. Like, it was, what was it, PG-13?
It was PG.
Oh,
there's,
PG.
There's not nearly anything that's...
Yeah, I guess nobody says damn or hell in it, so it's PG.
No, that's the thing about the subversiveness of the movie, is that there's nothing really that you can pin anything to on that film,
right.
Even though the coding is there, they don't spell it out for you. So girls are throwing themselves on Pee-wee and he's not interested. Somebody tweeted that he was the original Volcel.
I also love that they kind of butched up Dottie. Like,
yes.
She's, you know, like, I kind of love that because, you know, she works at the bike shop. She kind of dresses a little bit more masculine. And like at that time, that was sort of like, you know, like the Eurythmics videos and stuff like that, that sort of like more masculine look was hot. But, you know, it's nice that they took some chances with that.
Exactly. I mean, it's a really good point, is that, it was a tough time to be a gay person in
right.
the '80s. And, that's what I value so much about the Pee-wee persona, was that he was completely in character and completely comfortable in his own skin. And he presumed that you knew what was going on, so he didn't have to spell it out for you.
Yeah, and encounters a cast of characters from every sort of walk of life and is equally welcoming to everybody. Like, that is, you know, that is the thing that got carried over into the television show, is that he's never like, who's this, or like, well, you know, your culture is so strange to me. It's like, no, like, hey, this person's here, I'm very excited, I'm gonna learn, you know. And that's beautiful.
And no culture could be strange to Pee-wee, because he's instantly the weirdest person in any room he walks into.
That's right.
This is crack, rock cocaine. It isn't glamorous or cool or kid stuff. It's the most addictive kind of cocaine, and it can kill you. What's really bad is nobody knows how much it takes. So every time you use it, you risk dying. It isn't worth it. Look, everybody wants to be cool, but doing it with crack isn't just wrong. Could be dead wrong.
Did you know people who didn't let their kids watch Pee-wee?
No. Was that a thing?
You know, I was a teenager when Pee-wee was popular, but I knew some kids who their parents did not approve of Pee-wee.
Oh my gosh, no. Now, when you say that, like, this is always like, there's this parallel universe I go into sometimes with my best friend. Cause she went to Catholic school, and she'll say to me sometimes like, oh yeah, like they used to tell us like what albums not to listen to. And they used to tell us like to not watch, you know, much music, or mm-hmm. I was like, what? Like I grew up in, like, as much as like we could get into a whole discussion about all the horrible things that my parents did and thought about, they were extremely liberal as far as like, I was allowed to read any comic book. I was allowed to read Mad Magazine. I was allowed to watch pay TV. Like I said before, and I, you know, they were, you know, like, I remember watching Monty Python movies when I was a kid and not getting it at all because I was too young.
Yeah.
Like, and being like, you guys sure like to watch some dumb shit. Like, you know, it's like, you know, it's the classic, like when you're a kid, you're like, ew, you drink wine. That's gross.
Yeah.
Okay. Give it a little time.
Well, yeah, I mean, that. This was the thing. Eventually, the mainstream culture got their revenge on Paul Rubens. But for a long time, you couldn't pin anything on him, right? Like, he was
right.
Very queer, and it was on television, you know, and he was a children's entertainer. So that's also drives a lot of people crazy. And, you know, we see this to this very day, is the idea that people love to equate homosexuality with pedophilia.
Yeah.
Like the right. And so it drove them up the wall that, like, Pee-wee was massively popular. Like, you couldn't escape him at some point in the 80s. He was everywhere. And he was himself, and he was showing other oddballs and outsiders in the world that you can also be yourself. And mm-hmm. he was, the vitriol with which people attacked him later on when he was vulnerable.
Yeah, for sure.
Just goes to show you.
Yeah. Yeah. People really like did not care for that kind of success. And I think it's probably because there really were those two streams. There was the hey, here's the action figure or cereal or candy stream. And then mm-hmm. here's the children's television workshop stream, which ironically enough had its own problems that we found out later about. But, it's interesting because I think people really tried to pin it down and, they weren't expecting that just as many adults were going to watch Pee-wee's Playhouse as children. And that really became the hallmark of that show, was how beloved it was. Like you talked about your David Letterman and stuff. I'm sure he watched all of the episodes. I'm sure, it was a cult favorite with people for a reason. And it was equally funny whether you were 4 years old or 44 years old. So I can totally see why, there used to be episodes of it on Netflix. I have no idea if that is still true. So please don't at me. But I remember watching a bunch of them. I think it was at the beginning of COVID, they were all on there. And I think I watched all of them while the weed was holding up. Ever. Other people are like, oh, I ate 2 pints of Haagen-Dazs in a row in one sitting. And it's like, okay.
The way I describe Pee-wee Herman is that for Generation X, he was the personality that spanned the extremes of that generation. So little kids who were Gen X would get up in the morning to watch Pee-wee on Saturday morning, whereas older kids and college age kids would watch it as a hangover cure, or they would come home from being out on drugs all night and come down by watching Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Like eating pancakes, but for two different reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. Like he was being watched by the entire generation. So yeah, I mean, I watched Pee-wee religiously and I taped it when I wasn't going to be home on Saturday morning so that I could watch it later. But lots of friends of mine, that was the thing. They would do acid all night and then, eventually wind up at somebody's house in the morning and watch Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yeah.
appreciate it on a different level than the little children.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I guess, it's funny and it had all this great stuff and we keep talking about it from a merit-based perspective. But it also, I'm sure was very comforting to a lot of people because happy colors, everybody is being kind to one another. The music is rad. You haven't even brought up who did the music on it, but I'm sure you did some research.
I know. it was Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo.
Yeah. And there was some other ones. And Cyndi Lauper sang the theme song for the cartoon.
Well, CBS had wanted Rubens for an animated cartoon for Saturday mornings, but instead they signed him up for a much more ambitious program. The budget was very high for Pee-wee's mm-hmm. Playhouse. It was $350,000 an episode. Children's television was a fraction of that.
Right. And
for a live program, a program shot in a studio, much cheaper.
We know, we live in Canada. A lot of stuff that was exported was shot in Canada for that exact reason.
Mm-hmm. The other great thing about Pee-wee's Playhouse, though, is it was a laboratory for creativity. It wasn't just Paul Rubens' vision for things. He had great art directors. Mm-hmm. He had great animators. He had great designers. They were throwing all this energy into putting this program on. There's too much to look at. Mm-hmm. on any given episode of Pee-wee.
Yeah, and people went on to huge careers. The guys who did the claymation on there went on to do Wallace and Gromit, right?
I read that the very first season was filmed in New York City in a cramped warehouse space, and then they moved on to Los Angeles where they had a more expansive studio space. It was packed out also with very, very funny people. People who would soon become famous, like Sir Lawrence Fishburne was on mm-hmm. the show as Cowboy Curtis. Mm-hmm. And Phil Hartman.
Esapatha Murkison is yes. that her name? Yeah. I was like, I hope I get this right. I'm kind of bad at that. So
One of the things that I loved about Pee-wee's Playhouse was the secret word.
Yes.
This was in league with children's entertainers of the 50s and 60s. Like the comedian Soupy Sales used to have a kid show, and he used to do things that would get him in trouble. Like he would tell the kids watching at home that they should go into their parents' wallets and take those little green pieces of paper out and mail them to the studio and stuff right. like that. Like he was, got in shit for it. I love children's entertainers who try to sort of stir shit up for the viewers at home. So the secret word was a segment where on every episode, Conky the robot would inform Pee-wee what the secret word of the day was. And when anybody utters it on the show, you're all supposed to scream with the word flashing on the screen. But parents were complaining because for the rest of the week, kids would just keep on screaming the word.
Yeah.
And when they would be trying to talk to their kids, they'd all say the word and they'd start screaming. Some of the words included this and that.
Yeah.
There was an episode where it was this the secret word. So that episode was really funny because all that was happening was screaming while people were trying to talk. So it would take like a minute to get a sentence out.
Right. I love it. I mean, you know, I think that that just like speaks to like this just like lizard brain version of comedy that we all find funny. You know what I mean? It's like in Canada, for the folks who, you know, didn't get to see this, who didn't live in border states, we have Juste pour rire, and they had like a television show, and they were, and like it was all these pranks or whatever. And like the pranks on those shows are so fucking stupid, but you laugh every time. And I may have told this story before, so you can cut it if I have, Jesse. But when I lived in China, and you would have to, so I lived in Hong Kong, and when you would have to cross the border into mainland China, there's obviously like the, you know, the foreigner line for the people who don't have like, you know, free travel ability into mainland China. And so you'd have to stand there and wait, but they had these TVs up and they would always show Mr. Bean, because Mr. Bean does not require any kind of language. It doesn't require any kind of subtitles. Right.
Right.
And to watch people from every socioeconomic background all laugh at the same time at Mr. Bean while standing in one of the most soulless places on earth is truly a life-affirming moment in a weird way. And I think that that's part of the vein that that show tapped into, is that like some of this shit is just funny because it's like stupid. It's just like, and life is stupid sometimes, and people are stupid sometimes.
And television is stupid sometimes.
Of course.
And this was a show made by very, very smart people about how silly you can be, which was also the secret sauce for David Letterman, was that, you know, you could have stupid pet tricks for 10 minutes on the show.
The Velcro wall. The lady who used to come out and like with the grinders and like grind on her boobs or whatever. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I was a regular Letterman viewer, and it was like the funniest. It was just the funniest.
When they used to throw shit off the roof at their old studio, that was another one.
They had a hydraulic press where they would just come up with shit to crush with a 500-ton press.
Remember when there was like a series of shows where they went out to LA and then they did all these drive-through pranks. Do you remember that?
Of course.
Yeah, just like taking advantage of what's available and just like making it so fucking stupid.
And that sweet spot of comedy where even if it's not funny, it starts to become very, very funny.
Right.
Like one of my favorite what the fuck moments in Pee-wee's Playhouse was, there was a gag where Pee-wee feeds his dog Roosevelt, and the camera just stayed on Roosevelt eating from his bowl for what felt like an eternity. It's like maybe 2 minutes of just a close-up of a dog eating.
Right.
on network television on a Saturday morning. Like it might start to become unfunny, and then it just starts to become very, very funny all over again because nothing's happening.
Yeah.
Like this is advanced comedy, and Pee-wee was delivering that.
how great that you can be 4, 5, 6 years old watching that and getting a lesson in why this is funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it being able to laugh along with your older siblings or with your parents or with, you know, just older people in general. Like, that's wonderful.
There was a very, very funny secret word episode where the word was Zizzy Baluba. So Conky spits out the word Zizzy Baluba and people are like, what? That's not a word. And then about 20 minutes into the show, this scary alien showed up towards the end and his name was Zizzy Baluba. So when he appeared, everyone started screaming. But as it turned out, the alien was not evil, just misunderstood. And that's a theme that Pee-wee would always return to, was the idea that there aren't really bad people, just people having a bad day or people who are misunderstood. Another wonderful moment on Pee-wee's Playhouse was when they had an episode where they were doing pogo stuff and they cut to a shot of all these pogo punks in LA, pogo dancing,
yeah,
which is like pure counterculture, like in 1986.
Right. Or people would not have known what that is. Yeah.
Well, the older cohort of Gen Xer knew who the pogo punks were. For sure. We're all laughing because it's like, hey, Pee-wee knows about pogo punks.
Yeah.
And it was probably legit pogo punks. I heard that Larry Fishburne, when he was young, was in the punk scene in LA.
Oh, that's as well. Cool. You know, when we talk about just like style and the design and everything, the whole Cowboy Curtis outfit with the Jerry curl and like the very like almost what's it called, like, you know, the Mexican cowboys, but like when they have like the really fancy outfits and the pointy shoes, like that's sort of almost bordering on that look. And like, there's something so wonderful about that. He's like Cowboy Curtis slash Prince slash like, a Mexican cowboy.
Yeah. Well, it's America, you know, and yeah. Pee-wee had Americana all throughout the program. Mm-hmm. I also loved it any time that Pee-wee was a control freak on the show. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there is a sort of like dark streak in Pee-wee that is almost never really surfaces, but it's sort of the undertone sometimes, because after all, this is Pee-wee's Playhouse. Mm-hmm. So I noticed that whenever they would play role-playing games with the other characters, that Pee-wee would always insist on being the authority figure and would start bossing them around. Mm-hmm. Whenever there was an opportunity for him to like assert dominance, he always took it. And but it was Pee-wee Herman doing it too.
It's so on brand too, right? Because he was dressed meticulously, everything in his house, even though it was like chaos, it was controlled chaos, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and when you see like even with the breakfast machine, like there's no spills coming off of the breakfast machine. The breakfast machine is perfect.
That's what's so funny, because he's like a complete anarchic, chaotic character, but he's so well dressed and so gentlemanly, you know. It's just so funny, and it's like aspirational. I think a lot of little gay kids saw Pee-wee and saw a future for themselves.
Like, I'm gonna build a breakfast machine so great.
So Pee-wee was on for 5 years, canceled in 1991. Mm-hmm. So 1990 was the final season. CBS had already canceled Pee-wee when the scandal happened.
Right. And people forget that part.
Yeah, because people think that the show was canceled because of porn theater.
Right. But like, it happened in the off season and then they were like, well, you're not coming back. That's not what happened.
What did happen, though, was CBS was planning to air reruns of the show that season. They canceled that plan.
Yeah, that would have been like a multi-million dollar loss they took on that for sure.
As I was saying to you off air, it was very difficult to go through that week where we lost Sinead O'Connor and then a few days later we lost Paul Reubens.
Yeah.
Because they were defiantly themselves as famous, famous people. And they were both treated very, very badly. Like when the mainstream got their chance to punish these people, they took it.
Yeah. And it's so funny because now, like, if like a extremely mainstream performer is like, hey, gays, like everyone's like, oh, my God, Taylor Swift said, hey, gays. And like it's in the news cycle for 3 weeks and you can't stop hearing about it. Mm-hmm. But it's like, back then, these people had huge media footprints. Like, it's hard to accurately describe to people who are used to a hit show having 4 million viewers to explain to them that, like, Pee-wee's Playhouse, I don't know, I didn't look it up, but you could probably look it up and do an insert, but it probably got like 16 million viewers because of just the lack of options for television versus what we have now. Like, it just, the audience was enormous. And like you said, like, you know, CBS made sure that there was merchandise. They made sure that, like, there was co-productions and things like that. And so it was, he had a huge media footprint. You know, Sinead O'Connor, same thing. She worked with Prince. She had a number one song. You know, you don't get on SNL with nobody knowing who you are. The thing that he didn't do was really apologize for it. I mean, there was probably some kind of perfunctory, like, sorry, whoops kind of thing, but it wasn't like he went on an apology tour. He made it, you know, part of, you know, he made a point of doing something about it. And what's so interesting, I was thinking about this today, is that, you know, you flash forward 30 years and Fred Willard gets caught doing the exact same thing. And most people probably don't even remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Fred Willard was a cult figure. And people just sort of, when it happened, people were like, oh, well, you know,
yeah.
He was, but, you know, in
and
the grand
scheme
of things.
He was like, oh, well, about it. He was like, oh, you know what? Well, like, when in Rome, like, you know, he was already in the porno theater, might as well take it out. Like,
yeah.
Duh.
The details of the incident with Paul Rubens was that he was arrested in the lobby of an adult movie theater called the South Trail. And was charged with exposing himself. And I finally got the answer to my question, because I was wondering what the movies were in the cinema that night. And I've got their names. One was called Nancy Nurse. One was called Turn Up the Heat. And the third film was called Tiger Shark.
Oh, my God. I love it.
Whenever anybody gets arrested in a movie theater, I'm like, what was the movie? You know,
those don't even sound like, you know, like current to the day porno movies. They sound like kind of like fun porno movies from the 40s, you know what I mean? Like something that you would show like the GIs.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, big whoop, as far as I'm concerned, being arrested in a porn theater, like that's
for doing the thing that people are going to a porno theater for. Like, I don't think there's anybody that walked in there thinking that they were expecting to see the Criterion Collection of Akira.
Yeah. And also he wasn't targeted. When the cops arrested this guy for indecent exposure, and then they found out when they took him in that it was Paul Rubens. He didn't look like Pee-wee Herman at the time.
Right.
He had a goatee and long, long hair.
As much as he was in that character for 13 years, when he was out of it, he was very much out of it. And I mean, probably deliberately so. Probably, you know, I remember being a kid and my mother telling somebody, oh, I read this article about Johnny Carson and he can only travel to France because they don't know who he is there. And I remember that, like, why do I remember that so deeply? But it's like, I'm sure that there was something to that as well, that people didn't want to, like, he probably didn't want people to recognize him at the fucking Gelson's.
Yes. Or at the porn theater in Paris.
Right.
But, you know, and Paul Rubens was technically out of a job at this point, you know, and he, by the mugshot, you can tell that he was now getting to be somebody else instead of always having to be Pee-wee Herman.
Yeah.
It was embarrassing. He eventually pleaded no contest to a charge of indecent exposure, and he paid a very small fine, but the damage was done.
Right.
Lots of people were making really revolting comments about Pee-wee, homophobic comments as well as, you know.
Well, look, when adults are taking their children to the porno theater, they want to know that children's entertainers are not at the same porno theater. It's a very simple request.
Yeah, it's true. He could have had a little activities table.
Right. I mean, it is such a perfect example of like what the vibe was like during that time. Like, still coming off of the satanic panic, so people weren't like saying, "Oh, like, you know, this preschool is full of Satanists," but people were still like, "Oh no, like, queer people are to be feared. Like, I don't know, every now and again, every about 6 months on Twitter, that I think it's a Newsweek cover where it's like bisexuality. And it's like talking about how it's like a new thing.
Yeah.
And it was from like 1991 or something. And I'm like, oh, okay. and it's just like, you know, I think that people don't really have a sense of just how putrid some of the vibes were. Like, there were great vibes elsewhere. I mean, 1991, you're talking about like when RuPaul started showing up on like, you know, television shows and things like that. And like, you're also talking about a time period where we were deeply past the like, oh no, like AIDS is here to stay. AIDS is killing people. And you know, Reaganism didn't leave when he left office. Like, there was still a real hard right turn that we had to course correct on. And I'm not sure that we ever really fully course corrected on it, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, so I'm sure all of that colored the way that this was covered. And you have to remember, like, that time period too was when all of the like sleazy tabloid shows started coming out, right? Like A Current Affair and all that shit. So they needed this kind of like tittle-tattle. Like, when you think about TMZ, people are like, oh, TMZ, it's like so seedy and whatever. And they know when every celebrity dies, whatever. Like, that's just A Current Affair. They just have more people that they pay less money to go and chase those stories. But it's all ambulance chasing stories. Like,
But people were very quick to equate the fact that Paul Reubens was in an adult movie theater with that he's a pervert and he's a children's entertainer. Therefore, you know, I told you so, you know?
Right. I know. And like, when you think about what has come out since about other people who were so much more beloved during that time period, you know,
Jimmy Savile,
Rolf Harris, all those people, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, no, they all touched kids and they were super duper into it. And they had lots of accomplices at their, you know, television station.
Lots of enablers.
Employer. Yeah.
And money talked with those people, like, you know.
Right.
Anyway, but Reubens, he showed up at the MTV Awards about 2 months later as Pee-wee, and that was a great moment.
Heard any good jokes lately? What was that one? Oh, so funny I forgot to laugh.
Thank you very much. That really means a lot to me. Thank you.
What a comedic genius to do that, first of all. I mean,
very brave.
Yeah. Too,
because, you know, they let him on TV, but like, you know, he wasn't going to be destroyed by, even though he did take a bit of a, he wasn't really in the public eye very much. Certainly not as Pee-wee Herman. We went a few years without seeing Pee-wee, but, I thought it was very important for him to tell a funny joke in the middle of all this.
Yeah. No, I mean, we often think about like celebrity scandals and stuff, but that's sometimes the fastest way to get through the shit. When you think about Hugh Grant, he did something very smart, which is he went on Jay Leno almost immediately after and was like, ho, 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 like,
right.
Because at the end of the day, who among us has not like wanted to like get it in or like whatever, get some head and, you know, and been pretty liberal about the way that we wanted to get there, you know? So I think a lot of people are like, this really isn't in the grand scheme of things that big of a deal. And like, thank God we got to the Fred Willard place where he was able to just be like, well, what are you going to do? And like,
yeah. Yeah.
Like, fair enough.
And to a certain extent, Paul Reubens made it there. Like, when he passed away, the top story wasn't all about the guy who got arrested in the movie theater. That was, that was the sort of thing that the blue check idiots would remind you of. But most of the discourse about Pee-wee on the day he died on Twitter was all love and all memories and all positivity.
It was about the show. I loved the show. I loved this. And then it was like about, you know, other people coming through and saying like how they affected him in real, they affected them in real life. So like, oh no, he actually was like super sweet and wonderful. And one of my biggest regrets now, because this has happened, is that I missed meeting Paul Rubens by 5 minutes once. Sad. In Austin, Texas at South by Southwest. He was being interviewed. I did sit through the whole interview. He was interviewed by Scott Aukerman. At the time, Scott Aukerman and some other folks were like, yeah, come backstage after the show or whatever. And he had just literally just left by the time I got there. And I was like, fuck, I missed him.
What would you have said to him?
Oh my God. I don't even know. I think there's like so few people in this world I'm legitimately starstruck by. I probably wouldn't know what to say around him. I probably would fully have a brain fart and just be like, oh.
One more little thing to say about the porn theater incident. Paul Rubens claimed innocence throughout his life. He did not deny that he was there, but he did say that he wasn't masturbating in the theater, in fact, and his legal team were planning to prove it. The police said in their report that he was using his left hand. Mm-hmm. Paul Rubens is right-handed, and he was apparently prepared to bring in experts from Masters and Johnson to assert that nobody masturbates with their non-dominant hand. That was going to be his defense.
Wow. You know what? Good thing that he got that defense in before jackandworld.com. He would have been proven wrong.
Yeah, there's probably a non-dominant hand subcategory, right?
Oh, yeah. There's the, like, sit on your hand subcategory. There's that website used to fucking crack me up so bad as a kid when I discovered it. I was just like... Like I wasn't weirded out by it or whatever. I was not horny by it by any stretch of the imagination, but I just thought it was fucking hilarious that people would sit around and be so bored that they'd be like, okay, here's what you do. First things first, get some plasticine, then get a grapefruit. Then, and you're like, what the fuck is going on?
Now, there was... a child porn charge against Paul Rubens. He got swept up with the arrest of Jeffrey Jones.
Right.
Pee-wee was had a little visit to his house. And it's not fair what this allegation was, because he apparently had an extensive collection of, you know, campy porn stuff.
Vintage pornography.
And, you know, there were a couple of items in his collection that were not, you know, full on child pornography, but, you know,
you couldn't determine the age.
Yeah. Either you couldn't determine the age, or you couldn't exactly explain why this isn't that sort of thing. So he pled a sort of a similar sort of no contest charge, but he stressed that, he's a weirdo, but he was not that kind of a weirdo, and that his collection wasn't about that anyway. It wasn't jerk off material. It's weirdness.
And the thing that I read was that it wasn't sexual acts being portrayed. So it was like the equivalent of like a Playboy kind of centerfold kind of thing. Like someone wasn't fucking, they were just nude, mm-hmm. which I think also probably makes a difference. Maybe not in a child pornography case, but if you're making the case that it's not sexual acts being portrayed versus like just a nude photo of someone that was taken like, you know, in the 1920s and you don't have their driver's license to back it up.
Yeah.
But also,
and you also can't assert why you have that collection, like what the use of it is. It's right. Like it's kitsch.
Well, you know, this also speaks to you know, the whole, you know, queer coding, queer history, whatever. Like, you know, I'm sure that there are images out there and reels out there and whatever that are of queer pornography, queer sexy images, whatever, that like should be preserved. Like, you know, my best friend is an archivist, and it's really funny because when you talk to her about stuff, I'm sure people are like, oh God, she's basically a librarian. But she's like, no, we should preserve pornography. We should preserve these kinds of things because it tells us a lot about culture. And it, you know, it's important not just to preserve copies of the Bible and pictures of people with nice teeth. You have to preserve everything, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, maybe that is part of, you know, what was, you know, what was behind the collection too, is that like, hey, these images exist. You can collect them in places and, you know, have a collection and preserve a collection. I'm sure that he didn't ask for those to be burned in his will. So they're probably going somewhere. And I hope, you know, I hope they go somewhere wonderful. I hope like,
but yeah, it was just unpleasant. Things that he had to endure. And, you know, once he was vulnerable, people went after him too.
Mm-hmm.
I want to mention briefly that, Paul Reubens was in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie shortly after the arrest. Right. That was one of his most significant parts. And his instructions to the makeup department were that he wanted to look as much like his mugshot as possible.
Well, they character. Did a good job. I saw that movie like 100 years ago and I have not seen it since. And the proof of that is that I got it confused with the TV show earlier when we were talking, so, which I also don't have a lot of experience with. But I have seen photos of it. And then obviously like when he was in What We Do in the Shadows, like he had like a complete, like he just redid the look.
I don't know. Did you ever see Blow? The Johnny Depp course. Movie?
Yeah.
He's really good in that film.
He's amazing in it.
In fact, the movie sort of takes a dive when his character leaves.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he was so good in that movie. A rare dramatic part for him, but I loved him in that.
I miss the aesthetics of having the roach clip. Like, that fell off as like mm-hmm. a thing, but he's like, he fully has the roach clip going in that movie. And there's something about that. And with all the fucking stores, all the paraphernalia, everything that you can get now, no one has like successfully rebooted the roach clip with like something cool. But you know what would happen now is that it would be like, you know, the Apple Project Red roach clip and it would cost like $89.
Yeah. Pee-wee made a trilogy of movies. The third one came along much later. I never saw Big Top Pee-wee. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about it?
So yeah, it's really toothless, and it was sort of meant to capitalize on the popularity of Pee-wee more than like have like a story that really appealed to the people who loved Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a bad movie. It's just not a Pee-wee movie. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Pee-wee's just in it.
Nobody told me to go see it, so I didn't see it.
Yeah. The weirdest thing, I never saw it for years. I had a picture book of it. Like, so you know how they used to do like, it's not a novelization, but it's like for children or whatever. And it's like a picture book version of it. And so I knew like the basic story of it, but it wasn't until many years later that I finally saw it. So it's like, I've never heard anybody say that they saw this, they loved it, whatever, might as well see it. And then I was like, oh yeah, I can see why people didn't really talk about this much. You know, I mean, it's for a movie that's all about like somebody who like is, you know, traveling across the country with a circus, it should be a lot zanier and more wonderful. And like, it does have like a romantic sort of subplot in it too, which like does not feel authentic for the reasons we explained before.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just it's not a mess of a movie. Like, if it were a mess of a movie, I would say go see it because like, you know, there's value in a messy movie. I mean, I was on here talking about Myra Breckinridge, so yeah. I'm the queen of that. But, you know, it's not even worth being like, it's a messy movie. You got to see it.
Yeah. But on your recommendation to mark the passing of Pee-wee, I watched Pee-wee's Big Holiday.
Yeah.
Finally.
Let's talk about it.
From 2016.
Boy.
Little background on this was it was a long gestating project. He'd been trying to get it going for years. I mean, he took several years off from being Pee-wee and then he brought it back in around 2010 and movement started to make that third Pee-wee movie with Judd Apatow's production company. It started over at Universal Pictures and it wound up becoming a Netflix movie. You described Pee-wee's Big Holiday as a queer classic.
Yes.
And I'd like you to expand on that.
I did because it was able to take the chances that you know, it wasn't able to on the children's television show for obvious reasons. And, you know, it really, I mean, it has a romance in it, but it's between Pee-wee and Joe Manganiello, which is like, it's so funny to cast like the guy who was like the hunk on True Blood.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and like has been in like these action movies and stuff. And like, I mean, they're not together anymore, but like famous for like, you know, marrying the sexiest lady on television and stuff like that. And like,
right. Manganiello, of course, from Magic Mike, too, where everyone went insane.
Right. Yes. So, yeah, like this, like, exceedingly masculine, hunky dude that it, you know, strikes up a pure and wonderful friendship with Pee-wee, wink, wink, over their shared love of miniatures and root beer barrels and, you know, whatever it was, sundaes or milkshakes or whatever, like just a beautifully done. And like, you know, Simone comes back and she's like this, you know, the prototypical like grand dame that like,
you know, sounding like Lauren Bacall too.
Yes. And that, you know, like, when you say like, hey, like who's like a diva kind of a person that all the gay kids would look up to, that is what Simone is when she's in her flying car. Like, just a beautiful turn for her because she was such a like mild mannered, you know, backwoods sort of lady who just wanted to go see Paris. And so she goes to Paris and she comes back like a real, you know, she's seen it all. And I love that. And obviously like that has, you know, some queer connotation to it as well. I mean, I think it's just, it was able to really push the envelope on the camp aspect and really push the envelope on, we all know why we're here. And, you know, because obviously the people who had watched it were 25, 30, years older than they were when they first watched the television show. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're able to have those conversations and be like, you know what this is, right? And like, you know, and it's a different time, obviously. And, you know, Netflix almost by accident has quite a large catalog of queer television shows, queer movies. And they do quite well. And that's why they launched that that Twitter channel The Most. That's why they have Trixie and Katya reviewing their television shows. You know, they really sort of leaned into that once they realized that that was something that was catching fire with them. And like, it's nice to have something where kids can be like, hey, like, I remember watching this show. And now I can pick up on all this stuff I didn't pick up on before. And it also reflects a more modern environment. And I, you know, so I think it is successful in that it shows this, like, it shows this male romance in a very Pee-wee way.
Yeah.
Pee-wee was never going to, like, you know, get on the back of Joe Manganiello's, you know, Harley or Ducati or whatever. And they were, you know, going to go get married in Palm Springs. Like, it was... Yeah. Right. Like, you know, it still has to be Pee-wee.
And Pee-wee being in his 60s at this point now, but right, still getting away with being Pee-wee Herman. Like, it's not like the timelessness of the character is it's got a built-in weirdness that can't be defeated, right, by the advance of time.
Yeah.
Like, he's all in, completely committed. And also, there's more hilarious content of Pee-wee turning down the advances of women.
Yes.
They have that extended farmer's daughter joke,
right,
in the film where he's in this house, this farmer who seems to have 9 daughters, and they're, mm-hmm, all, there's a long sequence where they're all knocking on his door.
They're all horny, yeah.
They're all horny for Pee-wee. And he's like, I'm saving myself for marriage.
Yeah.
You know, like, so funny. Yeah.
And it... just talking about what we were talking about with the show too, like that particular part of the movie also has one of the most outrageously Pee-wee scenes in it, which is the balloon.
Yes. More it's time like, I'm standing listening still.
To a fucking balloon for 4 minutes. I'm going to lose my shit. When that comes on, when the dog is around, you better watch the fuck out because he hates it.
Oh, oh, he hates. Yeah, because the movie basically comes to a standstill while Pee-wee lets out air very slowly and obnoxiously from a balloon.
Yeah, and it's really high pitched and wee. Like, oh, it's. I'm trying not to like make it a sound that sounds too close to it because I don't want the dog to bark at me. But yeah,
yeah. But, you know, a little bit bittersweet when I think about it, because Paul Reubens had been living with his illness for about 6 years or so, which basically puts it at around the time this movie was made.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know how much of mortality was worked into it. But in losing Reubens last week, I thought the beginning of Pee-wee's Big Holiday was almost too much to bear, because Pee-wee was having a dream where he was saying goodbye to this sort of little alien friend. Yeah. And he's really acting in that scene. He's fighting back tears. He's saying, I'm going to miss you. And it was very moving to watch that when I was just thinking about how sad it is that he's gone.
Yeah.
It's like a comedy movie that starts with this very dramatic and sincere moment.
Yeah, and if you looked up the two unproduced scripts that Paul wrote for, a Pee-wee revival, we're probably blessed that he teamed up with Paul Rust to do this one, because there was one that was like very dark and like, you know, Dark Knight Rises, but Pee-wee coded, and then, which I can only imagine that must have been like, I'm sure, given the time period that it was written, because it was like, oh, he becomes really famous and he becomes a jerk. I'm sure it was like an Andrew Dice Clay kind of a like riff kind of a thing. And I'm like, I kind of would have liked to see that, but maybe also not. And then the other one sounded more like a Big Top Pee-wee kind of a premise, where it's going back to the playhouse and could have been good, could have been bad. And so It was really a stroke of luck that he teamed up with Paul Rust. And I honestly think, like, to Paul Rust's credit, he took the subject matter so seriously in writing this movie. You can tell that there's care taken with it, with the character, and also with the events in the movie, that none of it seems either too zany or too cheesy or too gross out or too, you know what I mean? Like, this could have gone into a lane where it couldn't have recovered, but it doesn't. It stays firmly like, this is Pee-wee. You know, my day job, I write about brands, and I work with brands for a living. And so this is the kind of conversation that we would have, where we'd say, this is an established brand. The tone of voice is consistent. But that matters when you have something that people hold so dearly from their childhood. It matters when it's a piece of work that you spent 13 years of your life crafting, and that nobody could buy from you, nobody could correct you, nobody could give you studio notes on. It matters for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And it matters too that that character got a happy ending, and it didn't just get severed by Paul Reubens' personal life and the obnoxious tone of the mainstream media and the sort of desire to make sure that this square peg gets pushed into that round hole. Mm-hmm. Like when Sinead O'Connor ripped up the photo of the Pope, you know, it was like a litmus test for all these people that I knew who thought that, you know, that was so terrible for her to do that and stuff. Yeah. And I was like, it rocked, actually.
Who cares? Yeah. I mean, people need to remember that everybody knew what the Catholic Church was getting up to, but it wasn't until that time period that it started becoming a news item. Like, such is the Holy See and their, you know, their spending ability and their, you know, their ability to keep a story quiet. If you ever want to see something that will like rock your shit, watch a documentary on Netflix called The Vatican Girl or something like that. It's about this girl who, her parents worked at the Vatican, and she was going to school and she was abducted, and it became this huge scandal because of the conditions under which she was abducted and never seen again and whatever. You'll have to see it to get the whole story. And there's unreliable narrators and whatever. And then of course, when they had the Vatty Leaks document drop, her story got reopened because it shed new light on it. But the power that the Catholic Church had to keep that shit under wraps and to keep that storyline of it's only a few bad apples going for so long to the point where people would believe it. Like, I don't know how you grow up in a situation where you know that there's like residential schools happening and the kids are having the shit beat out of them and they're being raped and whatever. And then also hear that about the Catholic Church and go, oh, well, that's only a few bad apples. Like, mm-hmm. It's so bizarre to me that, you know, even to this day on Twitter, if you talk about stuff, you'll be, you know, if you say like, oh, if you don't, you know, people will be like, oh, I don't want my kids to go to a drag show or whatever. You're like, okay, well, if you don't want your kids to get raped, don't send them to church. And then they're like, well, that's only the Catholics. You're like, how are you a fucking adult who pays taxes and you think it's only the Catholics? Mm-hmm.
Thankfully, Sinead was vindicated by history.
Well, and history has nothing but disdain for women who tell the truth, right? Like, it's one of the worst things that you can be or do is to be a woman and tell the truth. So, hasn't really served people well over the years.
Sinead and Paul Reubens were extremely brave people who got to be themselves and be famous at the same time. Their careers were hurt at a time where your career could be hurt.
Yes.
It feels like now people could be, you would think that things would destroy people and then they don't actually get destroyed by what they go through. Although the rhetoric in our time is all about cancellation and stuff like that. But like Shane O'Connor was a victim of cancel culture, if anybody was.
Of course. You already get in enough trouble with Marvel people, but like, let's talk about how like, you can do just about whatever the fuck you want if you work for Marvel. And there are several examples that come to mind, none of which I will name, but we all know who they are.
Right. Yeah. Now you just don't see them for a while. And then the corporations hope you've forgotten about these people.
Exactly.
But, and then sometimes we haven't forgotten about them.
No. And it's always interesting to me who people will rush to defend and be like, oh, you're pillorying this person. And then the people who they'll be like, well, no, that's fair game. They knew what they were getting into, because it's always like, you know, the person who's at the porno theater, the person who, you know, spoke the truth about something, instead of the person who's like, oh, I stole from a pension fund. And also, I think that Jews run the media. And, you know, you're like, that's the person that should be pilloried. And we shouldn't be having a discussion over the level to which that should be happening. Everybody should know, you know, when they see fascism, when they see like these uber capitalists fucking killing people and like, you know, union busting and whatever, being like, no, those are the bad guys. Like, every movie shows you those are the bad guys. And yet we still have this discussion about, oh no, the actual bad guys are the guy that like pulled his dick out one time and the lady who ripped up a photo on TV. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing. Like, I think that people need the cultural context too of what happened there. Like, I'm not, he said he never took it out. Great. But if he did, OJ Simpson, if he did it, here's how he did it. No, look, that was a time, like we said, the AIDS crisis meant that saunas, bathhouses, all these places where people used to congregate for, you know, consensual, no strings attached action, those got shut down by public health departments and they were not allowed to reopen and their licenses were suspended permanently. And places that had, you know, this plus a sauna or whatever couldn't get like liquor licenses or stuff. Like, they tried to really hem that shit in. So when you consider like now all you have to do is download an app on your phone that takes 15 seconds and you can have dick to your door, any color, any flavor of the rainbow, within an, you know, 15 minute time period, and you can say, this is what I want to do, this is what I'm into, and the person knows as soon as they come there what they're going to be in for. That didn't exist back then. Mm-hmm. So if people were getting their kicks in these like little seedy areas, which everybody knew they were little seedy areas, like this wasn't like it wasn't next to a daycare center. It wasn't like, oh, there's an entrance to a Wendy's and it gets confused with the Wendy's. Like, this is these. If you've ever been to Southern California, you know exactly what neighborhood you're in.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, like, you know, in his defense, he said he wasn't doing what they were saying that he was doing, but it shouldn't even matter.
No, that's the point.
Because it was nobody's business.
Right. Nobody else at that movie theater thought that they were at the Gelsons. Nobody thought that they were voting. Nobody thought they were at church. They all knew what they were doing there, why they were there, what they bought their ticket for.
The thing that I loved more than anything about Pee-wee was that his character came with an entire world attached to it.
Yes.
He wasn't just Pee-wee Herman. There was the playhouse. There were all the little characters that came along with him. All these creative people coming together and creating this little in-universe world for Pee-wee to play in and for us to be invited to. Mm-hmm. There's something to be said for children's entertainment that's not actually trying to teach you anything except that there's value in creativity and that there's value in being yourself.
Right. And being a kid is fun. Like, that can be the message. Being a kid is fun because you get to do all this stuff. You get to look out a window and imagine what the flowers be like if they were singing, you know?
Yeah.
Also, you know, it's very funny because, like, you know, when you say, like, oh, you know, you couldn't do this on television anymore. There's one thing that that he did on his show that you couldn't get away with doing anymore. And it's, when I say it, you're going to be like, oh, yeah. There's an episode where he makes sun tea in a window, and you would not be able to show that to children anymore because that is a bacteria vector, and you would not be able to put that on children's television anymore.
Did you ever see the episode, though, where Pee-wee got married to a fruit salad?
Yes.
That got past standards and practices.
That's fine. It's a salad. We can see the salad. It's fine. Pee-wee left an indelible mark on my life for sure. My dog is named Pee-wee for that exact reason. I was at a bar in the neighborhood recently, and the dog was allowed to come with us. And someone was like, oh, what's your dog's name? And I said, Pee-wee. And then she looked at me and I was like, as in Herman. And she started laughing. Yeah, and I mean, his post-career, like, I thought The Mystery Men was one of the best movies, because it really, I mean, I know we've already talked about this, you get in trouble all the time for talking about Marvel movies, because there is such a machine behind those superhero movies, and Mystery Men really took that and, like, put it on its ear at a time before this whole machine even got up and running. And just like, and it was based on like a extremely weird comic book, and everybody in it got to be their big weird selves, you know. And I think his job in that movie as the spleen didn't have a lot of lines, but everybody remembers it.
Karen, thank you so much for joining me once again. Where can people find you on social media?
Now I have to give a list of like six different websites because Twitter shit.
Don't call it X, please.
No, you can follow me on Twitter at KarenGeier. Same on Instagram, same on Threads. And also it's just KarenGeier.com on Blue Sky because you're allowed to use your own URL, and I have my own URL, so.
Do you say URL? Yeah. I would say URL.
Oh, that's a GIF and JIF conversation. But yeah.
Karen, thank you so much for joining me. It was very nice also to see you in real life last month.
Yes, I know. When Brian came to visit, that was a really fun weekend. And it was so funny that, you know, he descended on my neighborhood during the middle of the Pride weekend and was like, yeah, let's do some Pride shit, and then I want you to take me to Canadian Tire. Like, that was...
This is Brian Quinby. We were his escorts. We showed him downtown Toronto, and it included going to Canadian Tire with him.
Yeah, and the weirdest little shoe store I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, it was fun, and I had a new respect for Canadian Tire after seeing it through Brian's eyes.
Through Brian's eyes, I know. He was like, this is awesome. I'm like, you're looking at briquettes that you can get at home. Like, I don't understand what the fascination is.
Karen Geyer, thank you so much for joining me. Please come back anytime.
Yeah, no, I thank you so much for having me, because this was really, like, close to my heart, so I appreciate it.
Patrons of the podcast help to make Junk Filter possible, and patrons get access to every episode of the show, including all of the episodes of this summer's sidebar series on Miami Vice. To become a patron, please go to patreon.com/junkfilter, and please follow us on Twitter @junkfilterpod. We'll have another episode in the next few days. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you for listening.